Exploration with Dr. Mishu Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and the City College of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And leading off first, we're going to summarize some of the top stories of the past week. At the Fukushima nuclear site, the TEPCO utility has now begun the process of putting a plastic shroud, that's right, a plastic blanket around Unit 1 in order to capture some of the dangerous radiation that continues to be emitted from the reactor. If successful, then perhaps the entire reactor site will eventually be shrouded in plastic. However, bad news for the cleanup operation. January of 2012 was supposed to be the target time for going into cold shutdown, that is, the point at which boiling water no longer exists on site. However, they now realize that the cleanup operation is taking place much slower than expected. The reactor is not stable by any means. The pumps are not working as planned. As a consequence, they're going to miss the January date. Also, Mars is in the news. The Mars Opportunity rover has begun the process of scanning the Endeavour crater. After a three-year journey, it now trekked up to the top of the Endeavour crater, 14 miles across, beginning a new era in the exploration of Mars. Not to mention that after Thanksgiving, NASA intends to shoot a new space probe at the Red Planet. And then we're going to bring on our special guest today. We're very glad to have with us Michael Marriott, a director of NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service. And he's going to give us an overview of not just the reactor accident at Fukushima, but what's happening in Europe, what's happening in the United States, what happened to the so-called nuclear renaissance that was supposed to take place. Unfortunately, the Fukushima accident took place even as the media hype around the nuclear renaissance was about to start. What's happening with the nuclear renaissance? We'll ask Michael Marriott that question. So let's begin with the top stories of the past week. It's been about 5 months now since the nuclear accident at Fukushima. Even though it's not in the headlines, the reactor is still not in a stable configuration. Boiling water is still being produced, they're not yet in cold shutdown, and radiation continues to be spewed into the environment, in part because there was a breach of containment. We still don't know the extent at which molten uranium penetrated the reactor vessels, but the assumption is that exposed molten uranium is in contact with cooling water, and that's causing radiation to continue to be spewed into the atmosphere. As a consequence, TEPCO has taken the unprecedented step of encasing Unit 1 in plastic. That's right, a plastic shroud, a blanket, has now been placed over Unit 1, held in place by metal girders, and they hope that that will capture some of the radiation which continues to leak out of the reactor. Eventually, they hope to encase Units 2 and Units 3 as well, or for that matter, as many nuclear components as they can that are leaking radiation into the atmosphere and the environment. Already, radiation has been detected 150, 200 miles from the reactor site, past Tokyo, in fact. Radiation is already beginning to be found in the sea fish, vegetation, drinking water, milk, you name it. Radiation has been detected, though we should emphasize at a very low level. But it's still causing a disturbance among the community. Many residents are voluntarily buying their own Geiger counters and scintillation counters because they simply don't believe the reassuring words of TEPCO. Not to mention the fact that the cleanup operation has been delayed. January 2012 was supposed to be the deadline to go into cold shutdown. That is the point at which boiling water is no longer produced by the reactors. However, the pumps are not working properly. Realize that because there's a hole at the bottom of the reactor, we think, by dumping cold water on top, you create lots of radioactive water on the bottom, radioactive water that does not flow in the circuit, but has to be separately contained in gigantic storage vats on site. Well, these storage vats are filling up, and so at some point, the utility may be forced to dump some of that highly radioactive water into the oceans, which would create an international incident with regards to Korea and China. So what they want to do is they want to get the pumps working to circulate the water in a loop. That way they can use the same cooling water over and over again, and the cooling water would be in contact with water from the oceans, but there would be a barrier so that the cooling water in the loop does not contaminate the water from the outside. Well, that's the goal. However, they're not meeting the goal. The January deadline has now been pushed back, and we simply don't know when TEPCO will be able to stabilize the reactors. That's important because that means that the reactor is essentially a ticking time bomb. Because it's not yet in cold shutdown, it means that another secondary earthquake, a pipe break, an emergency evacuation of workers could start the accident all over again. Because water is basically manually dumped on the reactors, an evacuation of the reactor operators and workers would leave the reactor in free fall. And at that point, water levels could begin to drop once again, exposing the melted cores, and the accident starts up all over again. Not to mention the fact that just a few weeks ago, radioactive hotspots were found at the reactor site, over a million times normal levels. In other words, radioactive levels were so great in two ventilation shafts that the average worker would get a lethal dose of radiation within a matter of seconds. Not years, but seconds, the worker would get a lethal dose of radiation. It's believed that the origin of this problem is a residue of the hydrogen gas explosion which took place back in March. Because the explosions took place and because monitors were not in place during most of the accident, it means that workers simply did not know that lethal quantities of radiation were continuing to come out of the ventilation shafts. Now that workers can get access to certain parts of the site, they realize that yes, indeed, there are radioactive hotspots where radiation levels are a million times above normal levels. Not to mention the fact that hotspots on a much lower level have been found throughout the Fukushima area. Every few weeks, apparently, new hotspots are being found because when radiation came out of the reactor accident, it deposited unevenly. For example, if it rained, many fission products are water-soluble, and the rain would then concentrate the radiation into certain areas. As a consequence, the discovery of these hotspots is also beginning to slow down the cleanup operation. Also, there's news from Mars. Within the last few weeks, there have been several press releases about the Red Planet. First of all, we had two rovers on Mars that landed in 2004. They were supposed to last 3 months. Instead, they lasted 7 years, which is a real record. One rover, the Spirit rover, actually conked out last year, probably because its solar batteries no longer function. However, the other rover, Opportunity, still keeps on chugging, just like the ever-ready bunny rabbit. This time, the Opportunity rover roved over 3 miles to the top of the Endeavour crater, which is 14 miles across, giving a panoramic view of the Martian horizon. The whole purpose is craters like Endeavour are time machines. That is, they gouge out enormous layers of ancient rock, exposing rock that goes back billions of years. And so by analyzing the clay and analyzing the rock, they essentially look at the history of Mars. That's one of the goals of the Opportunity rover, now at the top of the Endeavour crater. Now, craters billions of years ago on Mars filled up with liquid water. There probably was a lake in the Endeavour crater billions of years ago, leaving clay. As a consequence, the Opportunity rover hopes to analyze the clay for evidence that there was in fact a lake inside this crater and possibly look for evidence of microbial life. And speaking about life, the Mars orbiter, which is continuing to orbit the planet taking pictures from outer space, has detected streaks, telltale streaks, coming from the rim of some of the giant craters on Mars. That could mean, and this is could with an underline under it, it could mean that there is liquid water flowing on the Red Planet. Now, the Red Planet is frozen solid. In fact, it is a frozen desert. So the presence of liquid water on Mars is quite startling. However, you have to realize that salt water freezes at a lower temperature than ordinary water. In fact, that's the reason why we salt large areas after a gigantic snowstorm. And as a consequence, it may mean that brine, that is salt water, could in fact flow freely over Mars during some of the seasons on the Red Planet. This, of course, is still speculation, but it does give impetus to the theory that perhaps there are hot springs underneath the surface of Mars where life may still exist. Of course, that's a long shot, but that's one possibility because at the present time, we do not have the capability of drilling into the Martian soil itself. And also we should mention that NASA has big plans for the future exploration of the Red Planet. After Thanksgiving, NASA will launch the space probe called Curiosity at the Red Planet, otherwise known as the Mars Science Laboratory. This science laboratory is chock full of scientific gadgetry, specifically aimed to find evidence of microbial life and evidence of the presence of ancient water on the Red Planet. So with the launch of Curiosity after Thanksgiving, we hope to have a much better understanding of Mars billions of years ago. Mars formed about 4.5 billion years ago along with the Earth, but Mars cooled down earlier than the Earth, being farther away. So Mars was tropical with oceans when the Earth was still molten. However, 3.5 billion years or so, Mars lost its liquid water. Its oceans either froze, or perhaps some of it went into the ice caps in the form of snow, or some of it went underground in form of permafrost, or some of it just drifted into outer space as the water began to boil. So 3.5 billion years ago, Mars lost its liquid water. But we see evidence of liquid water everywhere on the Red Planet. We see ancient riverbeds. We see the outlines of a gigantic ocean about the size of the United States of America on the Red Planet. So we know that 3.5 billion years ago, Mars was in some sense tropical, no evidence of life as we know it, but the temperatures were mild and there was plenty of liquid water on the Red Planet, even while the Earth was still practically molten. And in fact, that has given rise to a rather unorthodox theory that postulates that perhaps DNA was formed on Mars first. Then perhaps a meteor hit the Red Planet, shot some DNA into outer space in the form of rock. After millions of years, the rock then landed on the Earth and seeded the Earth with Martian DNA. Well, of course, this theory has not been verified, but if it's true, it means that if you want to look at a Martian, simply look in a mirror. Perhaps we are the Martians. We should also point out that the earliest that a manned space mission could go to Mars would be around 2035, at the very earliest. President Barack Obama has stated that he wouldn't be surprised if in the 2030s there is a manned mission to the Red Planet, but it's not going to happen under his watch. In fact, it's still question mark as to what this Mars mission may even look like. At the present time, there are no funds allocated for a new booster rocket. To get out of Earth's gravitational field into Martian orbit would require a new booster rocket that we simply don't have. And even if we do go to Mars, there's speculation that in order to cut costs, we'll land on the moons of Mars first. Because the moons of Mars are quite small, they have low escape velocity. It wouldn't take much to leave the moons of Mars. In fact, you could run you could run and jump into space and leave the moons of Mars. That's how small they are with such a small gravitational field. So once we go to Mars, well, hey, let's face it, we may not even land on the red planet at all. We may actually land on the moons of Mars. I'd like to introduce our special guest today. We're very delighted to have with us Michael Marriott, a director at NIRS, the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington. And we're going to talk today about the Fukushima nuclear accident 5 months later. What about the long-term implications? What about the cleanup operation? What's happening in Europe? What about President Barack Obama's plan to have a nuclear renaissance? These and other questions we'll discuss with Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, NIRS. Michael, first question for you is, explain, what is NIRS?
Well, NIRS is Nuclear Information and Resource Service. We're an organization founded in 1978 to serve what was then and remains today a very decentralized grassroots movement against nuclear power and for safe and clean energy sources. We work to achieve a nuclear-free, carbon-free energy future. And we monitor what's happening in Washington as well as around the world, really, get the information to the people across the country, help them understand it, and help them use it. We have a website at NIRS.org, and we also have three different Facebook pages, and we're on Twitter, so our outreach is getting pretty good.
Okay, so what is your spin on the Fukushima nuclear accident? Many people have analyzed it, but what are your thoughts? How severe was the accident? And then, of course, we'll talk about the long-term implications.
Well, of course, at Fukushima, we had multiple meltdowns, something few people ever thought would happen. We had multiple fuel pool failures, something few people ever thought would happen, and we had them all at the same time. In a lot of ways, this was the most challenging nuclear accident ever. It remains to be seen whether it will eventually rank as the most catastrophic nuclear accident ever, or whether we'll be right up there with Chernobyl or not, because one key thing is that this is an accident that isn't over. The reactors continue to leak radiation. Currently, according to our best information, the levels are much, much lower than they were a few months ago, but they are still continuing at about a billion becquerels per hour, according to our best information. At the height of the accident, just for comparison, they were putting out hundreds of thousands of trillions of becquerels per day. So it's obviously it's gone down. But none of the reactors are yet in cold shutdown, which means there is still the possibility that new problems could occur, particularly through another earthquake or operator error or any of a number of various potential problems. And it just today, in fact, Tokyo Electric Power admitted that they're probably not going to make cold shutdown by next January as they've been planning. So we still have months to go before we can say this accident is contained. And then even then, we're going to have years and probably decades of pretty dicey cleanup of the mess that's left there. I mean, we have molten fuel at the bottom of three reactors. That's going to be an enormous task to try to deal with over the years. We've got hundreds of thousands of tons of contaminated water in these buildings. Again, that's going to be an enormous cleanup effort. So this is something that's going to be ongoing for a good long time.
And how severe was the accident? We now know from TEPCO's own admission that all three reactors suffered a 100% core melt. All the uranium melted. But what about breachment of containment? Is there any indication that the metal that surrounded the reactors actually began to melt and perhaps even leaked out some molten uranium?
It's very clear that there was indeed a breach of containment. Even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission admits that for at least some of the reactors. In fact, just before we began this interview, I was reading the Fukushima Task Force report, and it acknowledges that there was indeed breach of containment. We don't know how severe the breaches were because nobody can, of course, get there to take a look. The radiation levels are too high. But we also know that it's far more severe than Japan let on initially. And in particular, our belief is that the Unit 3 in particular, we believe there was probably an explosion in the fuel pool there, and that caused the fuel fragments to be blown across the area, across the site. And we think that's what accounts for some very extraordinarily high radiation readings that were found at Fukushima earlier this month, the highest readings yet. And we believe that this is because there are, basically pieces of hot fuel around the site that haven't been measured yet, and there's probably pieces of hot fuel throughout the evacuation zone with extraordinarily high levels of radiation. And again, this is something that's going to take months and years to deal with.
And what about the contamination that continues to come out of the reactor? What about contamination that's affected drinking water, milk, vegetation, farm products, fish? What are your thoughts?
Well, Japan has a very serious problem with contamination of food stuff right now. There have been numerous reports of contaminated beef, contaminated mushrooms, contaminated tea. I think the entire country is holding its breath now as the rice harvest is getting ready to go to market to see how contaminated that may be. And most of this contamination is caused by the initial releases early in the accident that were spewed over a large part of the countryside, especially to the northwest of the plant. But if you look at the radiation map, you're all over the place. 100, 120 miles away, there's hot spots that are quite contaminated. And so the contamination of elements like cesium-137 and others, it gets into the soil, the plant-based food sort of takes it up inside the food, and it becomes contaminated. The cattle were eating contaminated straw and hay. They ingest the radioactive cesium, and then the cattle themselves become radioactive. And it's a very serious problem throughout Japan. Another problem I want to bring up is that large areas of northern Japan that should have been evacuated, that are continuing to experience contamination levels higher than those the Soviet Union evacuated as a result of the 1986 Chernobyl disaster. Hundreds of thousands of people are living in areas like this and not being evacuated, probably more appropriately called relocated at this point. And we have situations such as we posted one on Facebook today where you literally have government officials going door to door in certain towns with radiation monitors, and they'll tell people in one household, you can evacuate, we will compensate you. And next door they'll say, you can't because we don't find a hot spot on your land. So it's a very ad hoc way of dealing with this issue, and in our view, a very cruel way of dealing with this issue. And the fact remains, we have hundreds of thousands of people, tens of thousands of children living in zones that are contaminated that should be evacuated. And I'll just make a pitch for this. We have a petition up on our website that we are working on in conjunction with our friends at Green Action Japan, an emergency petition to protect the children of Fukushima, and we hope people will sign that. In the early days of the accident, we sent over a number of radiation monitors to Japan through Green Action, and it was through these monitors that the scandal of the radiation levels at Fukushima schools were first discovered. So we were very happy to be part of this effort and part of what's a rapidly growing movement of mothers in Japan, you know, mothers in particular, to relocate their children into safer areas. But now that we have the information, now we need to bring about the political change to make it possible.
Now, the Japanese people are normally rather trusting of the government, and now we have a situation where people are buying decimeters and Geiger counters on their own, that local municipalities are giving out decimeters to children as young as kindergarten age. So do you see, therefore, that there's a sea change in people's attitude toward nuclear power in Japan?
Absolutely. And you're quite right. You know, the Japanese people had been told for many years, many decades, and this is partly in response to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that they've been told by their government that, yes, nuclear weapons are horrible, look what happened to us, but nuclear power is going to help Japan. And they were assured over and over again of safety, even while the government and the utilities in Japan built nuclear reactors on fault lines and failed to take steps to protect reactors from tsunami, built reactors such as the General Electric Mark I design, which is what was used at Fukushima, that have received numerous safety criticisms over the years. And the Japanese people, I think, now realize they were sold a bill of goods.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, we began an interview with Michael Marriott, Director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C., a nuclear clearinghouse of information. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. So stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration as we continue the discussion of the Fukushima accidents and the future of nuclear energy. Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C. And in this segment of Exploration, we're going to continue a discussion of the Fukushima reactor accident and its aftermath. What actually happened at Fukushima? How extensive was the damage? What about the cleanup operation? And of course, what about the international impact of that accident? What about Germany, Switzerland, Italy? What about the United States? And what about nuclear waste disposal? And whatever happened to the nuclear renaissance that was supposed to reinvigorate the sagging fortunes of nuclear energy? Once again, our special guest in this hour is Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service. Okay, now at Three Mile Island, there was no breach of containment, and yet it took 14 years to clean up. The crews had to put in TV cameras to photograph the melted core, and then with hacksaws, hack up the core into pieces and take each piece out, all of which took place underwater. And that was 14 years for a situation that was relatively under control. Do you foresee, therefore, that the cleanup operation at Fukushima could be many times worse?
Absolutely. Three Mile Island was quite easy compared to Fukushima. In fact, I was actually inside Three Mile Island watching the workers practice with these tools they were using. They were these very long-handled tools, about 20 feet long, and like you said, they would stand on this little ledge and try to cut molten fuel 20 feet below them underwater. And that was very easy compared to what's going to happen at Fukushima. Because at Three Mile Island, the fuel remained in the reactor pressure vessel. It was in a relatively small location. At Fukushima, it is melted and has moved out of the vessel. We don't know how far out yet. We may not even know that for years. So, yeah, I think we're looking at literally decades for cleanup. I know a couple months ago, Tokyo Electric Power received bids from two different companies for cleanup activities. One of the bids said, well, we think we can do it in 10 years. And the other bid said, well, we think we can do it in 30 years. And I think what we're really going to be looking at is decades before we actually have a cleaned up situation at Fukushima. I mean, remember that Chernobyl was 25 years ago. At Chernobyl, they built the sarcophagus fairly quickly, the large steel container around the site, but the sarcophagus at Chernobyl is not adequate, and so they're just now beginning work 25 years later on a more permanent sealing of that reactor. Fukushima is more spread out. There was damage over a wider area. It's going to be extraordinarily difficult and time-consuming and expensive to try to bring about to any sort of normalcy level.
Now, you mentioned 10 to 30-year estimates. One nuclear engineer has estimated that it may take as long as 100 years, a century, to clean up. At Chernobyl, there were 600,000 workers that were involved in that cleanup operation. 600,000 workers. Some of the workers only went in for a few minutes, getting a full year's dose of radiation. So what are your thoughts? You think it's going to take more than 30 years, maybe 50 years? These are the numbers being batted about now.
Well, I think at one level it's just impossible to know. And I mean, I think we're looking at decades easily. How many decades really depends on what is found under these reactors, inside these reactor buildings, when people can finally get into them, and we don't even know when that is going to be. So somebody wants to say a century. I'm not going to disagree with them. It's just impossible to know now, but it's going to be quite a long time, and it's going to be extraordinarily expensive.
Okay, now let's talk about the radioactive fallout from the Fukushima disaster. Just before the nuclear accident, people were saying that there's going to be a nuclear renaissance, that there's going to be a new emphasis on building safer designs of nuclear power, especially in light of the greenhouse effect, that nuclear could be the white knight, with President Barack Obama even endorsing a nuclear renaissance. So let's take it one country at a time. First of all, Germany. What's happening in Germany?
Well, Germany, you know, has had a nuclear phase-out policy in place. In the previous government, the current government overturned that policy when they came to power. Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Party. Now that party and Ms. Merkel have done an about-face, and Germany, in fact, is going to accelerate its nuclear phase-out. Seven reactors are already closed, and the other, I believe it's another 12 that they have, are going to permanently close around the end of this decade. And there is a clear commitment not to build any more. So Germany is leading the way to a non-nuclear future. And what's especially important about Germany, I think, is that they want to do this and are planning to do this in a way that switches them from nuclear and from fossil fuels to renewable sources of power and increased energy efficiency. This is the future that they now see as not only desirable, but feasible. And they are likely to show the rest of the world the way to do this. And they're, in that sense, they're going to be a terrific example for the rest of the world.
And what about Switzerland?
Switzerland also is ending its use of nuclear power. They won't be building any more. They will be. They have a scheduled phase out for their existing reactors. They only have one or two. They're not nearly as reliant on nuclear as Germany is. And their phase out, I believe, is at a later date than Germany's. They're not making as radical a statement as Germany is at this point. But the trend there again is clear. And, you know, one thing to remember about countries like Germany and Switzerland is these are not the kinds of countries you normally think of as sort of sunny resort areas, and yet these countries are going to be moving aggressively to solar power. In fact, Germany is already the most solar country in the world, and when people understand that countries like this can effectively use solar power, it's very clear that those of us in parts of the world that actually do have greater solar resources, there's no excuse for us not to do it.
And what about Italy?
Italy is interesting because the government there, Berlusconi's government, wanted to renew construction of nuclear power. In Italy, after Chernobyl, there was a referendum, and the people voted no more nuclear. Berlusconi's government has been actively working to overturn that over the last couple of years. And, in fact, the Italian utilities have been investing in nuclear plants in other countries, but they wanted to build more in Italy. Well, they had another citizens' referendum just about 6-8 weeks ago in which the government actively opposed, but the referendum won by some 90% of the vote, and Italy will very clearly not be building more nuclear power plants.
And going back to Japan, Japan, some people say, made the Faustian bargain. Faust was the mythical figure who sold his soul to the devil for unlimited power. Japan has very few alternatives, no coal, no oil, very little hydropower, so they went nuclear. So what's going to happen now with the future of nuclear energy in Japan?
Well, clearly, Japan is going to be much, much less reliant on nuclear power than it has been. And the only question is, will it be reliant at all on nuclear power? Most of Japan's reactors are closed. Japan had 55 reactors on March 10th, 2011. Six of those reactors, the ones at Fukushima Daiichi, are not operating, obviously, and are not going to operate again. But a majority of the other reactors across the country also have closed. Some did experience some effects from the earthquake, obviously not as severe as Fukushima. But Japan has an interesting law where in Japan, reactors after 13 months of operation have to close for inspections, safety inspections, and the like, something that we certainly don't do here in the U.S. And another part of the law is that the governors of the prefectures, which is the Japanese equivalent of states, the governors have to approve the restart of the reactors. And if the governor opposes it and doesn't want it, then the reactors can't start up again. So most of Japan's reactors are closed. Most of the governors have indicated they don't want the reactors to reopen, although today, in fact, the first reactor in Japan to restart after Fukushima started, I forget the name of it, but a governor did allow one reactor to start up today. There is a campaign to try to overturn that decision. But, you know, we have a situation where by next spring, the rest of Japan's reactors that are currently operating and have been operating this whole time will be going through their shutdown time. And it's by no means clear that the governors are going to allow the rest of these reactors to start up. So Japan may find itself a no-nuclear or a very small nuclear nation by default and by decree of the governors as early as next spring. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister Kan, not particularly popular in Japan right now because of the mishandling of the Fukushima crisis, but he has made it clear that from the government's perspective, the national government's perspective, Japan has to move away from nuclear power and very aggressively go after or improve energy efficiency. Although Japan is probably the most energy efficient country in the world already, and invest heavily in solar and wind power. And Japan does have pretty substantial wind power resources, and in fact, the offshore wind farms in Japan, although they were a little further from the epicenter than the reactors were, they continued operating throughout the earthquake and tsunami, and there's a lot more potential there for power. But that's the direction that Japan is planning to move in over the next decade.
Now let's talk about the United States, with President Barack Obama reaffirming his commitment to nuclear energy even after the Fukushima accident, but he also closed down the Yucca Mountains waste repository. Could you explain?
Well, there's two things. In the United States, there has been much talk about a nuclear renaissance over the past several years. At one point, we had something like applications for, I don't know, as many as 29 or 32 new reactors. In the U.S., the reality is that no licenses have been granted. No reactors are being built right now. Fukushima itself ended one project that was pretty far advanced in South Texas. NRG Energy, which was the lead sponsor of that project, withdrew after Fukushima, partially because one of its investors was, in fact, Tokyo Electric Power. So that one's already ended. And most of the other projects that have been proposed are running into what is for the utilities an unpleasant reality. These reactors cost too much to build. There are competing power sources that cost less to build and operate. And in fact, we are now at the point where even solar power, which has historically been quite expensive, in many parts of the country now, solar power is cheaper than nuclear power. And those parts of the country where it is not yet will be in the coming near-term future. So that if you're a utility executive trying to decide what you're going to build, and of course there's a lead time involved. Nuclear reactors take about 10 years to license and build at a minimum. And you're trying to look, so if you're a utility executive trying to look 10 years ahead, and even now we're seeing that solar and wind, and whether onshore or offshore, and of course natural gas, are not only economically competitive with nuclear power, but economically more beneficial than nuclear power. You'd have to be a pretty strange utility executive to invest heavily in nuclear at this point. And in fact, John Rowe, who is the CEO of Exelon, Exelon is the nation's largest nuclear utility, addressed the American Nuclear Society earlier this week and said that while he believes in nuclear power, the economics aren't there, and that in fact the economics for nuclear power in the U.S. have worsened over the past 2 years. To the point where it just doesn't make sense to build nuclear plants in this country. And that's with or without federal support. And because of the ongoing budget issues and the deficit issues, we're not expecting any additional federal support for nuclear power to be approved. President Obama had asked for $36 billion in taxpayer money for nuclear loans for reactors. We beat him on that last year, and we're winning on that this year as well, and we don't think it's going to happen. So there, and without federal loans, nothing is going to get built.
Now, the utility says, in its defense, that the next generation of reactors is much better than the Three Mile Island type reactors, which melted down back in 1979. So, describe this new generation of reactors. Are they really that safe?
Well, let me say two things. The reactors that the utilities are actually considering building, in other words, the ones that they have applied for licenses for, are not really a new generation of reactors. They're sort of a half generation of reactors. I sometimes describe them as the difference between a 1970 Chevy Impala and a 2010 Chevy Impala. I mean, they're obviously the 2010 model is probably safer and gets better gas mileage, but it's not much. It's fundamentally technologically not a lot different from the model 30, 40 years ago. And that's the case with the reactors that the utilities have applied to build. These are evolutionary differences between the reactors that exist now. There are reactor designs out there that are being touted by various nuclear proponents that have various features that appeal to the nuclear proponents, and they basically fall into two different categories. There are what's called the small modular reactors, which are far smaller than existing reactors or any that are planned now. Typical reactor in the U.S. is approximately 1,000 megawatts. These would be anywhere from 50 to about 300 megawatts apiece. So, much smaller. The idea is that, if we make them smaller, they'll be cheaper. You could put, several of them together on one site and still produce as much power, but it would be simpler to operate and cheaper to build, in theory. We think in practice, actually, the economic, whatever economic advantage that might seem to be would evaporate in real life, but because, you know, none of these reactors has actually been built, none of them has even been fully designed. But so that's one type of new reactor. The second type are what's called, sometimes called Generation 4 reactors. These, and there's a variety of different ones. What they have in common is that they are all designed on paper. Many of them would have a purported selling feature of using radioactive waste from other reactors as part of their fuel. And this would require implementation of a very large reprocessing structure in the United States that would be expensive, quite dirty, and problematic in a number of ways. In theory, these reactor designs, some of which have been around on paper for many years, some of which haven't, but in theory, these reactor designs would be passively safe, meaning that they wouldn't need a lot of valves and pumps and, you know, pieces that can break in order to ensure cooling, that the cooling would occur naturally. We're quite skeptical of all of these designs. One of them is the Integral Fast Reactor. The climate scientist, James Hansen, who we like a lot otherwise, has been touting these, but they another is a gas modular reactor, a pebble bed modular reactor. These are designs that have been around actually for a couple of decades, and nobody's ever built them because the economics of them don't make sense, and they probably don't work as well in practice as they might look on paper. We believe that we have the ability to generate the electricity we need through the sun, through the wind, through the water, through renewable means, and using the energy wisely, which means a combination of efficiency, you know, ensuring that everything is operating as efficiently electrically as possible, and sensible conservation. We can meet our electrical needs with those means. We don't need nuclear power of any kind to meet our electricity needs. And this renewable future is becoming reality faster than anybody is really noticing. I was in California last weekend, and I was talking to a friend of mine who's an executive at a large solar firm. And he was explaining to me that currently in California alone, there are proposals that have been filed with the state for 70,000 megawatts of solar power production. And that's not even including, you know, rooftop solar and the types of things that individuals do. By way of comparison, California uses about 60,000 megawatts of power total. And, you know, this 70,000 megawatts, that's only what's been, on file now. There's obviously plenty of companies that would want to build more. So solar is a rapidly, rapidly growing technology that is finally here. You know, 30 years ago, after Three Mile Island, I have to admit, our side, talked a lot about solar power, but solar power wasn't ready then. Wasn't ready for prime time, wasn't ready to power our nation. Things have changed, and solar power in much of the nation, both solar power plants and rooftop solar, home-based solar, industry-based solar, coupled with wind power, and in some cases, in some parts of the country where it can be done cleanly, geothermal power. These are our energy futures. They're here now, and we don't need the Generation 4 design, reactor designs, or any of the other designs that, regardless of their safety claims, which we're skeptical of, still produce radioactive waste.
And last question, what about Yucca Mountains? If the president has closed down, essentially, the Yucca Mountains waste repository, what are we going to do with nuclear waste?
Well, we have on our website a statement of principles that's been signed, endorsed by literally hundreds of organizations across the United States, including just about all of the big environmental groups and all of the nuclear-oriented groups. And it's called HOSS, H-O-S-S, which stands for Hardened On-Site Storage. And what these principles say is basically, we know, and it's clear, there is not going to be a permanent radioactive waste dump in the near future in this country. In fact, there's not going to be one anywhere in the world, but that's a different story. Because of that reality, and some of the groups here would like to see such a repository in place, but where it would be is, you know, not been agreed upon yet. But because of this, you know, fundamental reality that we have the waste that has been generated, and we have to deal with it, the best thing we can do with it right now is to store it on site at the reactor site in dry casks. We need to get it out of the fuel pools as quickly as it can be, which is after about 5 years in the fuel pool, because Fukushima has shown us, you know, the vulnerabilities of fuel pools. We need to get it out of the pools into the casks, and we need to have the casks in such a way that they are protected from both natural disasters and man-made disasters, such as you know, potential terrorists and that kind of thing.
I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest today was Michael Marriott, director of NIRS, the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C. Their website is NIRS.org, N-I-R-S.org. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And be sure to check out my latest book, Physics of the Future, now a New York Times bestseller. Good day.